landed there in 1540. When we camped on the estuary, which is said to have harbored his ships, we had not for weeks seen a man or a cow, an axe cut or a fence. Once we crossed an old wagon track, its maker unknown and its errand probably sinister. Once we found a tin can. It was pounced upon as a valuable utensil. Dawn on the delta was whistled in by gamble quail, which roosted in the mesquites overhanging camp. When the sun peeped over the Sierra Madre, it slanted across 100 miles of lovely desolation, a vast flat bowl of wilderness rimmed by jagged peaks. On the map, the delta was bisected by the river. But in fact, the river was nowhere and everywhere, for he could not decide which of 100 green lagoons offered the most pleasant and least speedy path to the gulf. So he traveled them all, and so did we. He divided and rejoined. He twisted and turned. He meandered in awesome jungles. He all but ran in circles. He dallied with lovely groves. He got lost and was glad of it, and so were we. For the last word in procrastination, go travel with a river reluctant to lose his freedom in the sea. He leadeth me by still waters was to us only a phrase in a book, until we had nosed our canoe through the green lagoons. If David had not written the psalm, we should have felt constrained to write our own. The still waters were of a deep emerald hue, colored by algae, I suppose, but no less green for all that. A verdant wall of mesquites and willow separated the channel from the thorny desert beyond. At each bend we saw egrets standing in the pools ahead, each white statue matched by its white reflection. Fleets of cormorants drove their black prows in quest of skittering mullets. Avocets, willets, and yellow legs dozed one-legged on the bars. Mallards, widgeons, and teal sprang skyward in alarm. As the birds took the air, they accumulated in a small cloud ahead, there to settle or to break back to our rear. When a troop of egrets settled on a far green willow, they looked like a premature snowstorm. All this wealth of fowl and fish was not for our delectation alone. Often we came upon a bobcat, flattened to some half-immersed driftwood log, paw poised for mullet. Families of raccoons waded the shallows, munching water beetles. Coyotes watched us from inland knolls, waiting to resume their breakfast of mesquite beans, varied, I suppose, by an occasional crippled shorebird, duck, or quail. At every shallow ford were tracks of burrow deer. We always examined these deer trails, hoping to find signs of the despot of the delta, the great jaguar, El Tigre. We saw neither hide nor hair of him, but his personality pervaded the wilderness. No living beast forgot his potential presence, for the price of unwariness was death. No deer rounded a bush or stopped to nibble pods under a mesquite tree without a premonitory sniff for El Tigre. No campfire died without talk of him. No dog curled up for the night, save at his master's feet. He needed no telling that the king of cats still ruled the night, that those massive paws could fell an ox, those jaws shear off bones like a guillotine. By this time, the delta has probably been made safe for cows, and forever dull for adventuring hunters. Freedom from fear has arrived, but a glory has departed from the green lagoons. When Kipling smelled the supper smokes of Amritsar, he should have elaborated, for no other poet has sung or smelled this green earth's firewoods. Most poets must have subsisted on anthracite. On the delta, one burns only mesquite, the ultimate in fragrant fuels. Brittle with 100 frosts and floods, baked by 1,000 suns, the gnarled imperishable bones of these ancient trees lie ready to hand at every camp, ready to slant blue smoke across the twilight, sing a song of teapots, bake a loaf, brown a kettle of quail, and warm the shins of man and beast. When you have ladled a shovelful of mesquite coals under the Dutch oven, Take care not to sit down in that spot before bedtime, lest you rise with a yelp that scares the quail roosting overhead. Mesquite coals have 7 lives. We had cooked with white oak coals in the corn belt. We had smudged our pots with pine in the north woods. We had browned venison ribs over Arizona juniper. But we had not seen perfection until we roasted a young goose with Delta mesquite. Those geese deserved the best of brownings, for they had bested us for a week. Every morning we watched the crackling phalanx head inland from the gulf, shortly to return, replete and silent. What rare provender in what green lagoon was the object of their quest? Again and again we moved camp gooseward, hoping to see them settle, to find their banquet board. One day at about 8 a.m., we saw the phalanx circle, break ranks, sideslip, and fall to earth like maple leaves. Flock after flock followed. At long last, we had found their rendezvous. Next morning, at the same hour, we lay in wait beside an ordinary-looking slough, its bars covered with yesterday's goose tracks. We were already hungry, for it had been a long tramp from camp. My brother was eating a cold roast quail. The quail was halfway to his mouth when a cackle from the sky froze us to immobility. That quail hung in midair while the flock circled at leisure, debated, hesitated, and finally came in. That quail fell in the sand when the guns spoke, and all the geese we could eat lay kicking on the bar. More came and settled. The dog lay trembling. We ate quail at leisure, peering through the blind, listening to the small talk. Those geese were gobbling gravel. As one flock filled up and left, another arrived, eager for their delectable stones. Of all the millions of pebbles in the green lagoons, those on this particular bar suited them best. The difference, to a snow goose, was worth 40 miles of flying. It was worth a long hike to us. Most small game on the Delta was too abundant to hunt. At every camp we hung up, in a few minutes shooting, enough quail for tomorrow's use. Good gastronomy demanded at least one frosty night on the stringer as the necessary interlude between roosting in a mesquite and roasting over mesquite. All game was of incredible fatness. Every deer laid down so much tallow that the dimple along his backbone would have held a small pail of water had he allowed us to pour it. He didn't. The origin of all this opulence was not far to seek. Every mesquite and every tornillo was loaded with pods. The dried-up mud flats bore an annual grass, the grain-like seeds of which could be scooped up by the cupful. There were great patches of a legume resembling coffee weed. If you walked through these, your pockets filled up with shelled beans. I remember one patch of wild melons, or calabacias, covering several acres of mudflat. The deer and coons had opened the frozen fruits, exposing the seeds. Doves and quail fluttered over this banquet like fruit flies over a ripe banana. We could not, or at least did not, eat what the quail and deer did, but we shared their evident delight in this milk-and-honey wilderness. Their festival mood became our mood. We all reveled in a common abundance and in each other's well-being. I cannot recall feeling, in settled country, a like sensitivity to the mood of the land. Camp-keeping in the Delta was not all beer and skittles. The problem was water. The lagoons were saline. The river, where we could find it, was too muddy to drink. At each new camp, we dug a new well. Most wells, however, yielded only brine from the gulf. We learned, the hard way, where to dig for sweet water. When in doubt about a new well, we lowered the dog by his hind legs. If he drank freely, it was the signal for us to beach the canoe, kindle the fire, and pitch the tent. Then we sat at peace with the world while the quail sizzled in the Dutch oven and the sun sank in glory behind the San Pedro Martyr. Later, dishes washed, we rehearsed the day and listened to the noises of the night. Never did we plan the morrow, for we had learned that in the wilderness some new and irresistible distraction is sure to turn up each day before breakfast. Like the river, we were free to wander. To travel by plan in the Delta is no light matter. We were reminded of this whenever we climbed a cottonwood for a wider view. The view was so wide as to discourage prolonged scrutiny, especially toward the northwest, where a white streak at the foot of the Sierra hung in perpetual mirage. This was the Great Salt Desert, on which, in 1829, Alexander Patti died of thirst, exhaustion, and mosquitoes. Patti had a plan to cross the Delta to California. Once, we had a plan to portage from one green lagoon to a greener one. We knew it was there by the waterfowl hovering over it. The distance was 300 yards through a jungle of cochineal, a tall spear-like shrub which grows in thickets of incredible density. The floods had bent down the spears, which opposed our passage in the manner of a Macedonian phalanx. We discreetly withdrew, persuaded that our lagoon was prettier anyhow. Getting caught in a maze of cochineal phalanxes was a real danger that no one had mentioned, whereas the danger we had been warned against failed to materialize. When we launched our canoe above the border, there were dire predictions of sudden death. Far huskier craft, we were told, had been overwhelmed by the tidal bore, a wall of water that rages up the river from the Gulf with certain incoming tides. We talked about the bore, we spun elaborate schemes to circumvent it, we even saw it in our dreams, with dolphins riding its crest and an aerial escort of screaming gulls. When we reached the mouth of the river, we hung our canoe in a tree and waited 2 days, but the bore let us down. It did not come. The Delta having no place names, we had to devise our own as we went. One lagoon we called the Relito, and it is here that we saw pearls in the sky. We were lying flat on our backs, soaking up November sun, staring idly at a soaring buzzard overhead. Far beyond him, the sky suddenly exhibited a rotating circle of white spots, alternately visible and invisible. A faint bugle note soon told us they were cranes, inspecting their delta and finding it good. At the time, my ornithology was homemade, and I was pleased to think them whooping cranes because they were so white. Doubtless they were sandhill cranes, but it doesn't matter. What matters is that we were sharing our wilderness with the wildest of living fowl. We and they had found a common home in the remote fastness of space and time. We were both back in the Pleistocene. Had we been able to, we would have bugled back their greeting. Now, from the far reaches of the years, I see them wheeling still. All this was far away and long ago. I am told the green lagoons now raise cantaloupes. If so, they should not lack flavor. Man always kills the thing he loves, and so we, the pioneers, have killed our wilderness. Some say we had to. Be that as it may, I am glad I shall never be young without wild country to be young in. Of what avail are 40 freedoms without a blank spot on the map? Song of the Gavilan. The song of a river ordinarily means the tune that waters play on rock, root, and rapid. The Rio Gavilan has such a song. It is a pleasant music, bespeaking dancing riffles and fat rainbows, layered under mossy roots of sycamore, oak, and pine. It is also useful, for the tinkle of waters so fills the narrow canyon that deer and turkey, coming down out of the hills to drink, hear no footfall of man or horse. Look sharp as you round the next bend, for it may yield you a shot, and thus save a heartbreaking climb in the high mesas. This song of the waters is audible to every ear, but there is other music in these hills, by no means audible to all. To hear even a few notes of it, you must first live here for a long time, and you must know the speech of hills and rivers. Then, on a still night, when the campfire is low and the Pleiades have climbed over rim rocks, sit quietly and listen for a wolf to howl, and think hard of everything you have seen and tried to understand. Then you may hear it, a vast pulsing harmony, its score inscribed on 1,000 hills, its notes the lives and deaths of plants and animals, its rhythms spanning the seconds and the centuries. The life of every river sings its own song, but in most the song is long since marred by the discords of misuse. Overgrazing first mars the plants and then the soil. Rifle, trap, and poison next deplete the larger birds and mammals. Then comes a park or forest with roads and tourists. Parks are made to bring the music to the many, but by the time many are attuned to hear it, there is little left but noise. There once were men capable of inhabiting a river without disrupting the harmony of its life. They must have lived in thousands on the Gavilan, for their works are everywhere. Ascend any draw, debouching on any canyon, and you find yourself climbing little rock terraces or check dams, the crest of one level with the base of the next. Behind each dam is a little plot of soil that was once a field or garden, sub-irrigated by the showers which fell on the steep adjoining slopes. On the crest of the ridge, you may find the stone foundations of a watchtower. Here, the hillside farmer probably stood guard over his polka-dot aquilettes. Household water he must have carried from the river. Of domestic animals, he evidently had none. What crops did he raise? How long ago? The only fragment of an answer lies in the 300-year-old pines, oaks, or junipers that now find rootage in his little fields. Evidently, it was longer ago than the age of the oldest trees. The deer love to lie on these little terraces. They afford a level bed, free of rocks, unupholstered with oak leaves, and curtained by shrubs. One bound over the dam, and the deer is out of sight of an intruder. One day, by aid of a roaring wind, I crept down upon a buck bedded on a dam. He lay in the shade of a great oak, whose roots grasped the ancient masonry. His horns and ears were silhouetted against the golden grama beyond, in which grew the green rosette of a mezcal. The whole scene had the balance of a well-laid centerpiece. I overshot, my arrow splintering on the rocks the old Indian had laid. As the buck bounded down the mountain with a goodbye wave of his snowy flag, I realized that he and I were actors in an allegory. Dust to dust, stone age to stone age, but always the eternal chase. It was appropriate that I missed, for when a great oak grows in what is now my garden, I hope there will be bucks to bed in its fallen leaves, and hunters to stalk and miss and wonder who built the garden wall. Some day my buck will get a 30-30 in his glossy ribs. A clumsy steer will appropriate his bed under the oak and will munch the golden grama until it is replaced by weeds. Then a freshet will tear out the old dam and pile its rocks against a tourist road along the river below. Trucks will churn the dust of the old trail on which I saw wolf tracks yesterday. To the superficial eye, the Gavilan is a hard and stony land, full of cruel slopes and cliffs, its trees too gnarled for post of sawlog, its ranges too steep for pasturage. But the old terrace builders were not deceived. They knew it by experience to be a land of milk and honey. These twisted oaks and junipers bear each year a crop of mast to be had by wildlings for the pawing. The deer, turkeys, and javelinas spend their days, like steers in a cornfield, converting this mast into succulent meat. These golden grasses conceal, under their wavering plumes, a subterranean garden of bulbs and tubers, including wild potatoes. Open the crop of a fat little Mearns quail, and you find an herbarium of subsurface foods scratched from the rocky ground you thought barren. These foods are the motive power which plants pump through that great organ called the fauna. Every region has a human food symbolic of its fatness. The hills of the Gavilan find their gastronomic epitome in this wise. Kill a mast-fed buck not earlier than November, not later than January. Hang him in a live oak tree for 7 frosts and 7 suns. then cut out the half-frozen straps from their bed of tallow under the saddle and slice them transversely into steaks. Rub each steak with salt, pepper, and flour. Throw into a Dutch oven containing deep smoking hot bear fat and standing on live oak coals. Fish out the steaks at the first sign of browning. Throw a little flour into the fat, then ice-cold water, then milk. Lay a steak on the summit of a steaming sourdough biscuit and drown both in gravy. This structure is symbolic. The buck lies on his mountain, and the golden gravy is the sunshine that floods his days, even unto the end. Food is the continuum in the Song of the Gavilan. I mean, of course, not only your food, but food for the oak which feeds the buck, who feeds the cougar, who dies under an oak, and goes back into acorns for his erstwhile prey. This is one of many food cycles starting from and returning to oaks, for the oak also feeds the jay, who feeds the goshawk, who named your river, the bear, whose grease made your gravy, the quail, who taught you a lesson in botany, and the turkey, who daily gives you the slip. And the common end of all is to help the headwater trickles of the Gavilan split one more grain of soil off the broad hulk of the Sierra Madre to make another oak. There are men charged with the duty of examining the construction of the plants, animals, and soils which are the instruments of the great orchestra. These men are called professors. Each selects one instrument and spends his life taking it apart and describing its strings and sounding boards. This process of dismemberment is called research. The place for dismemberment is called the university. A professor may pluck the strings of his own instrument, but never that of another. And if he listens for music, he must never admit it to his fellows or to his students. For all are restrained by an iron-bound taboo, which decrees that the construction of instruments is the domain of science, while the detection of harmony is the domain of poets. Professors serve science, and science serves progress. It serves progress so well that many of the more intricate instruments are stepped upon and broken in the rush to spread progress to all backward lands. One by one, the parts are thus stricken from the Song of Songs. If the professor is able to classify each instrument before it is broken, he is well content. Science contributes moral as well as material blessings to the world. Its great moral contribution is objectivity, or the scientific point of view. This means doubting everything except facts. It means hewing to the facts, let the chips fall where they may. One of the facts hewn to by science is that every river needs more people, and all people need more inventions, and hence more science. The good life depends on the indefinite extension of this chain of logic. That the good life on any river may likewise depend on the perception of its music, and the preservation of some music to perceive, is a form of doubt not yet entertained by science. Science has not yet arrived on the Gavilan, so the otter plays tag in its pools and riffles, and chases the fat rainbows from under its mossy banks, with never a thought for the flood that one day will scour the bank into the Pacific, or for the sportsman who will one day dispute his title to the trout. Like the scientist, he has no doubts about his own design for living. He assumes that for him, the Gavilan will sing forever. Oregon and Utah. Cheat takes over. Just as there is honor among thieves, so there is solidarity and cooperation among plant and animal pests. Where one pest is stopped by natural barriers, another arrives to breach the same wall by a new approach. In the end, every region and every resource get their quota of uninvited ecological guests. Thus, the English sparrow, rendered innocuous by the shrinkage of horses, was succeeded by the starling, who thrives in the wake of tractors. The chestnut blight, which had no passport beyond the west boundary of chestnuts, is being followed by the Dutch elm disease, with every chance of spreading to the west boundary of elms. The white pine blister rust, stopped in its westward march by the treeless plains, effected a new landing via the back door, and is now romping down the Rockies from Idaho toward California. Ecological stowaways began to arrive with the earliest settlements. The Swedish botanist, Peter Kalm, found most of the European weeds established in New Jersey and New York as early as 1750. They spread as rapidly as the settler's plow could prepare a suitable seedbed. Others arrived later, from the west, and found thousands of square miles of ready-made seedbed prepared by the trampling hoofs of range livestock. In such cases, the spread was often so rapid as to escape recording. One simply woke up one fine spring to find the range dominated by a new weed. A notable instance was the invasion of the Intermountain and Northwestern foothills by downy chess or cheatgrass, Bromus tectorum. Lest you gain too optimistic an impression of this new ingredient of the melting pot, let me say that cheat is not a grass in the sense of forming a live sod. It is an annual weed of the grass family, like foxtail or crabgrass, dying each fall and reseeding that fall or the next spring. In Europe, its habitat is the decaying straw of thatched roofs. The Latin word for roof is tectum, hence the label brome of the roofs. A plant that can make a living on the roof of a house can also thrive on this rich but arid roof of the continent. Today, the honey-colored hills that flank the northwestern mountains derive their hue not from the rich and useful bunchgrass and wheatgrass which once covered them, but from the inferior cheat which has replaced these native grasses. The motorist who exclaims about the flowing contours that lead his eye upward to far summits is unaware of this substitution. It does not occur to him that hills, too, cover ruined complexions with ecological face powder. The cause of the substitution is overgrazing. When the two great herds and flocks chewed and trampled the hide off the foothills, something had to cover the raw eroding earth. Cheat did. Cheat grows in dense stands, and each stem bears a mass of prickly awns which render the mature plant inedible to stock. To appreciate the predicament of a cow trying to eat mature cheat, try walking through it in low shoes. All field workers in cheat country wear high boots. Nylons are here relegated to running boards and concrete sidewalks. These prickly awns cover the autumn hills with a yellow blanket as inflammable as cotton wool. It is impossible fully to protect cheat country from fire. As a consequence, the remnants of good browse plants, such as sagebrush and bitterbrush, are being burned back to higher altitudes, where they are less useful as winter forage. The lower fringes of pine timber, needed as winter cover for deer and birds, are likewise being singed back to higher levels. To a summer tourist, the burning of a few bushes off the foothills may seem a minor loss. He is unaware that, in winter, snow excludes both livestock and game from the higher mountains. Livestock can be fed on valley ranches, but deer and elk must find food in the foothills or starve. The habitable wintering belt is narrow, and the further north one goes, the greater is the disparity between the area of habitable winter range and the area of summer range. Hence these scattering foothill clumps of bitterbrush, sage, and oak, now fast shrinking under the onslaught of cheat fires, are the key to wildlife survival in the whole region. Besides, these scattered bushes often harbor, under their mechanical protection, remnants of native perennial grasses. When the bushes are burned off, these grass remnants succumb to livestock. While the sportsmen and stockmen wrangle over who should move fast in easing the burden on the winter range, cheatgrass is leaving less and less winter range to wrangle about. Cheat gives rise to many minor irritations, most of them less important, perhaps, than starving deer or cheat sores in a cow's mouth, but still worth mentioning. Cheat invades old alfalfa fields and degrades the hay. It blockades newly hatched ducklings from making the vital trek from upland nest to lowland water. It invades the lower fringe of lumber areas, where it chokes out seedling pines and threatens older reproduction with the danger of quick fire. I experienced a minor irritation myself when I arrived at a port of entry on the Northern California border, where my car and baggage were searched by a quarantine officer. He explained politely that California welcomes tourists, but that she must make sure their baggage harbors no plant or animal pests. I asked him what pests. He recited a long list of prospective garden and orchard afflictions, but he did not mention the yellow blanket of cheat, which already extended from his feet to the far hills in every direction. As is true of the carp, the starling, and the Russian thistle, the cheat-afflicted regions make a virtue of necessity and find the invader useful. Newly sprouted cheat is good forage while it lasts. Like as not, the lamb chop you ate for lunch was nurtured on cheat during the tender days of spring. Cheat reduces the erosion that would otherwise follow the overgrazing that admitted cheat. This ecological ring around the rosy merits long thought. I listened carefully for clues whether the West has accepted cheat as a necessary evil, to be lived with until kingdom come, or whether it regards cheat as a challenge to rectify its past errors in land use. I found the hopeless attitude almost universal. There is, as yet, no sense of pride in the husbandry of wild plants and animals, no sense of shame in the proprietorship of a sick landscape. We tilt windmills in behalf of conservation in convention halls and editorial offices, but on the back 40, we disclaim even owning a lance. Manitoba, Clandeboy. Education, I fear, is learning to see one thing by going blind to another. One thing most of us have gone blind to is the quality of marshes. I am reminded of this when, as a special favor, I take a visitor to Clandeboy, only to find that, to him, it is merely lonelier to look upon and stickier to navigate than other boggy places. This is strange, for any pelican, duckhawk, godwit, or western grebe is aware that Clandeboy is a marsh apart. Why else do they seek it out in preference to other marshes? Why else do they resent my intrusion within its precincts, not as mere trespass, but as some kind of cosmic impropriety? I think the secret is this. Clandeboy is a marsh apart, not only in space, but in time. Only the uncritical consumers of hand-me-down history suppose that 1941 arrived simultaneously in all marshes. The birds know better. Let a squadron of southbound pelicans but feel a lift of prairie breeze over Clandeboy, and they sense at once that here is a landing in the geological past, a refuge from that most relentless of aggressors, the future. With queer antediluvian grunts, they set wing, descending in majestic spirals to the welcoming wastes of a bygone age. Other refugees are already there, each accepting in his own fashion his respite from the march of time. Forster's terns, like troops of happy children, scream over the mudflats as if the first cold melt from the retreating ice sheet were shivering the spines of their minnowy prey. A file of sandhill cranes bugles defiance of whatever it is that cranes distrust and fear. A flotilla of swans rides the bay in quiet dignity, bemoaning the evanescence of swanly things. From the tip of a storm-racked cottonwood, where the marsh discharges into the big lake, a peregrine stoops playfully at passing fowl. He is gorged with duck meat, but it amuses him to terrorize the squealing teals. This, too, was his after-dinner sport in the days when Lake Agassiz covered the prairies. It is easy to classify the attitudes of these wildlings, for each wears his heart on his sleeve. But there is one refugee in Clandeboy whose mind I cannot read, for he tolerates no truck with human intruders. Let other birds spill easy confidence to upstarts in overalls, but not the western grebe. Stalk carefully as I will to the bordering reeds, all I get to see is a flash of silver as he sinks, soundless, into the bay. And then, from behind the reedy curtain of the far shore, he tinkles a little bell, warning all his kind of something. Of what? I've never been able to guess, for there is some barrier between this bird and all mankind. One of my guests dismissed the grebe by checking off his name in the bird list and jotting down a syllabic paraphrase of the tinkling bell, crick crick, or some such inanity. The man failed to sense that here was something more than a bird call, that here was a secret message, calling not for rendition in counterfeit syllables, but for translation and understanding. Alas, I was, and still am, as helpless to translate it or to understand it as he. As the spring advances, the bell grows persistent. At dawn and at dusk, it tinkles from every open water. I infer that the young grebes are now launched in their watery career, and are receiving parental instruction in the grebe philosophy. But to see this schoolroom scene is not so easy. One day I buried myself prone in the muck of a muskrat house. While my clothes absorbed local color, my eyes absorbed the lore of the marsh. A hen redhead cruised by with her convoy of ducklings, pink-billed fluffs of greenish-golden down. A Virginia rail nearly brushed my nose. The shadow of a pelican sailed over a pool in which a yellow leg alighted with warbling whistle. It occurred to me that whereas I write a poem by dint of mighty celebration, the yellow leg walks a better one just by lifting his foot. A mink slithered up the shore behind me, nose in air, trailing. Marsh wrens made trip after trip to a knot in the bulrushes, whence came the clamor of nestlings. I was starting to doze in the sun when there emerged from the open pool a wild red eye, glaring from the head of a bird. Finding all quiet, the silver body emerged, big as a goose, with the lines of a slim torpedo. Before I was aware of when or whence, a second grebe was there, and on her broad back rode two pearly silver young, neatly enclosed in a corral of humped-up wings. All rounded a bend before I recovered my breath. And now I heard the bell, clear and derisive, behind the curtain of the reeds. A sense of history should be the most precious gift of science and of the arts, but I suspect that the grebe, who has neither, knows more history than we do. His dim primordial brain knows nothing of who won the Battle of Hastings, but it seems to sense who won the Battle of Time. If the race of men were as old as the race of grebes, we might better grasp the import of his call. Think what traditions, prides, disdains, and wisdoms even a few self-conscious generations bring to us. What pride of continuity, then, impels this bird, who was a grebe eons before there was a man? Be that as it may, the call of the grebe is, by some peculiar authority, the sound that dominates and unifies the marshland chorus. Perhaps, by some immemorial authority, he wields the baton for the whole biota. Who beats the measure for the lakeshore rollers as they build reef after reef for marsh after marsh, as age after age the waters recede to lower levels? Who holds sago and bulrush to their task of sucking sun and air, lest in winter the muskrats starve and the canes engulf the marsh in lifeless jungle? Who counsels patience to brooding ducks by day, and incites bloodthirst in marauding minks by night? Who exhorts precision for the heron's spear and speed for the falcon's fist? We assume, because all these creatures perform their diverse tasks without admonition audible to us, that they receive none, that their skills are inborn and their industry automatic, that weariness is unknown to the wild. Perhaps weariness is unknown only to grebes. Perhaps it is the grebe who reminds them that if all are to survive, each must ceaselessly feed and fight, breed and die. The marshlands that once sprawled over the prairie from the Illinois to the Athabasca are shrinking northward. Man cannot live by marsh alone. Therefore, he must needs live marshless. Progress cannot abide that farmland and marshland, wild and tame, exist in mutual toleration and harmony. So with dredge and dike, tile and torch, we sucked the corn belt dry, and now the wheat belt. Blue Lake becomes Green Bog. Green Bog becomes Caked Mud. Caked Mud becomes a wheat field. Someday, my marsh, diked and pumped, will lie forgotten under the wheat, just as today and yesterday will lie forgotten under the years. Before the last mud minnow makes his last wiggle in the last pool, the terns will scream goodbye to Clandeboy, the swans will circle skyward in snowy dignity, and the cranes will blow their trumpets in farewell. Part 3. A Taste for Country. Country. There is much confusion between land and country. Land is the place where corn, gullies, and mortgages grow. Country is the personality of land, the collective harmony of its soil, life, and weather. Country knows no mortgages, no alphabetical agencies, no tobacco road. It is calmly aloof to these petty exigencies of its alleged owners. That the previous occupant of my farm was a bootlegger mattered not one whit to its grouse. They sailed as proudly over the thickets as if they were guests of a king. Poor land may be rich country, and vice versa. Only economists make physical opulence for riches. Country may be rich despite a conspicuous poverty of physical endowment, and its quality may not be apparent at first glance, nor at all times. I know, for example, a certain lake shore, a cool austerity of pines and wave-washed sands. All day, you see it only as something for the surf to pound, a dark ribbon that stretches farther than you can paddle, a monotony to mark the miles by. But towards sunset, some vagrant breeze may waft a gull across a headland, behind which a sudden roistering of loons reveals the presence of a hidden bay. You are seized with an impulse to land, to set foot on bearberry carpets, to pluck a balsam bed, to pilfer beech plums or blueberries, or perhaps to poach a partridge from out those bosky quietudes that lie behind the dunes. A bay? Why not also a trout stream? Incisively, the paddles clip little soughing swirls athwart the gunwale. The bow swings sharp shoreward and cleaves the greening depths for camp. Later, a supper smoke hangs lazily upon the bay. A fire flickers under drooping boughs. It is a lean, poor land, but rich country. Some woods, perennially lush, are notably lacking in charm. Tall, clean, bold oaks and tulip poplars may be good to look at from the road, but once inside, one may find a coarseness of minor vegetation, a turbidity of waters, and a paucity of wildlife. I cannot explain why a red rivulet is not a brook. Neither can I, by logical deduction, prove that a thicket without a potential roar of a quail covey is only a thorny place. Yet every outdoorsman knows that this is true. That wildlife is merely something to shoot at or to look at is the grossest of fallacies. It often represents the difference between rich country and mere land. There are woods that are plain to look at, but not to look into. Nothing is plainer than a corn belt woodlot. Yet, if it be August, a crushed pennyroyal or an overripe mayapple tells you here is a place. October sun on a hickory nut is irrefutable evidence of good country. One senses not only hickory, but a whole chain of further sequences, perhaps of oak coals in the dusk, a young squirrel browning, and a distant barred owl hilarious over his own joke. The taste for country displays the same diversity in aesthetic competence among individuals as the taste for opera or oils. There are those who are willing to be herded in droves through scenic places, who find mountains grand if they be proper mountains, with waterfalls, cliffs, and lakes. To such, the Kansas plains are tedious. They see the endless corn, but not the heave and the grunt of ox-teams breaking the prairie. History, for them, grows on campuses. They look at the low horizon, but they cannot see it, as Devaca did, under the bellies of the buffalo. In country, as in people, a plain exterior often conceals hidden riches, to perceive which requires much living in and with. Nothing is more monotonous than the juniper foothills, until some veteran of 1,000 summers, laden blue with berries, explodes in a blue burst of chattering jays. The drab sogginess of a March cornfield, saluted by one honker from the sky, is drab no more. A Man's Leisure Time. The text of this sermon is taken from the Gospel according to Ariosto. I do not know the chapter and verse, but this is what he says. How miserable are the idle hours of the ignorant man! There are not many texts that I am able to accept as gospel truths, but this is one of them. I am willing to rise up and declare my belief that this text is literally true, true forward, true backward, true even before breakfast. The man who cannot enjoy his leisure is ignorant, though his degrees exhaust the alphabet, and the man who does enjoy his leisure is to some extent educated, though he has never seen the inside of a school. I cannot easily imagine a greater fallacy than for one who has several hobbies to speak on the subject to those who may have none, for this implies prescription of avocation by one person for another, which is the antithesis of whatever virtue may inhere in having any at all. You do not annex a hobby, the hobby annexes you. To prescribe a hobby would be dangerously akin to prescribing a wife, with about the same probability of a happy outcome. Let it be understood, then, that this is merely an exchange of reflections among those already obsessed, for better or for worse, with the need of doing something queer. Let others listen if they will, and profit by our behavior if they can. What is a hobby anyway? Where is the line of demarcation between hobbies and ordinary normal pursuits? I have been unable to answer this question to my own satisfaction. At first blush, I am tempted to conclude that a satisfactory hobby must be in large degree useless, inefficient, laborious, or irrelevant. Certainly many of our most satisfying avocations today consist of making something by hand, which machines can usually make more quickly and cheaply, and sometimes better. Nevertheless, I must in fairness admit that in a different age, the mere fashioning of a machine might have been an excellent hobby. Galileo, I fancy, derived a real and personal satisfaction when he set the ecclesiastical world on its ear by embodying in a new catapult some natural law that St. Peter had inadvertently omitted to catalog. Today, the invention of a new machine, however noteworthy to industry, would, as a hobby, be trite stuff. Perhaps we have here the real inwardness of our question. A hobby is a defiance of the contemporary. It is an assertion of those permanent values which the momentary eddies of social evolution have contravened or overlooked. If this is true, then we may also say that every hobbyist is inherently a radical, and that his tribe is inherently a minority. This, however, is serious. Becoming serious is a grievous fault in hobbyists. It is an axiom that no hobby should either seek or need rational justification. To wish to do it is reason enough. To find reasons why it is useful or beneficial converts it at once from an avocation into an industry, lowers it at once to the ignominious category of an exercise undertaken for health, power, or profit. Lifting dumbbells is not a hobby. It is a confession of subservience, not an assertion of liberty. When I was a boy, there was an old German merchant who lived in a little cottage in our town. On Sundays, he used to go out and knock chips off the limestone ledges along the Mississippi, and he had a great tonnage of these chips, all labeled and catalogued. The chips contained little fossil stems of some defunct water creatures called crinoids. The townspeople regarded this gentle old fellow as just a little bit abnormal, but harmless. One day, the newspaper reported the arrival of certain titled strangers. It was whispered that these visitors were great scientists. Some of them were from foreign lands, and some among the world's leading paleontologists. They came to visit the harmless old man and to hear his pronouncements on crinoids, and they accepted these pronouncements as law. When the old German died, the town awoke to the fact that he was a world authority on his subject, a creator of knowledge, a maker of scientific history. He was a great man, a man beside whom the local captains of industry were mere bushwhackers. His collection went to a national museum, and his name is known in all the nations of the earth. I knew a bank president who adventured in roses. Roses made him a happy man and a better bank president. I know a wheel manufacturer who adventures in tomatoes. He knows all about them, and, whether as a result or as a cause, he also knows all about wheels. I know a taxi driver who romances in sweet corn. Get him wound up once, and you will be surprised how much he knows, and hardly less at how much there is to be known. The most glamorous hobby I know of today is the revival of falconry. It has a few addicts in America, and perhaps a dozen in England, a minority indeed. For 2.5 cents, one can buy and shoot a cartridge that will kill the heron whose capture by hawking requires months or years of laborious training of both the hawk and the hawker. The cartridge, as a lethal agent, is a perfect product of industrial chemistry. One can write a formula for its lethal reaction. The hawk, as a lethal agent, is the perfect flower of that still utterly mysterious alchemy, evolution. No living man can, or possibly ever will, understand the instinct of predation that we share with our raptorial servant. No man-made machine can, or ever will, synthesize that perfect coordination of eye, muscle, and pinion as he stoops to his kill. The heron, if bagged, is inedible and hence useless, although the old falconers seem to have eaten him, just as a Boy Scout smokes and eats a flea-bitten summer cottontail that has fallen victim to his sling, club, or bow. Moreover, the hawk, at the slightest error in technique of handling, may either go tame, like Homo sapiens, or fly away into the blue. All in all, falconry is the perfect hobby. To make and shoot the longbow is another. There is a subversive belief among laymen that in the hands of an expert, the bow is an efficient weapon. Each fall, less than 100 Wisconsin experts register to hunt deer with a broad-headed arrow. One out of 100 may get a buck, and he is surprised. One out of 5 riflemen gets his buck. As an archer, therefore, and on the basis of our record, I indignantly deny the allegation of efficiency. I admit only this, that making archery tackle is an effective alibi for being late at the office or failing to carry out the ash can on Thursdays. One cannot make a gun, or at least I can't, but I can make a bow, and some of them will shoot. And this reminds me that perhaps our definition ought to be amended. A good hobby, in these times, is one that entails either making something or making the tools to make it with, and then using it to accomplish some needless thing. When we have passed out of the present age, a good hobby will be the reverse of all these. I come again to the defiance of the contemporary. A good hobby must also be a gamble. When I look at a rough, heavy, lumpy, splintery stave of bois d'arc, and envision the perfect gleaming weapon that will one day emerge from its graceless innards, and when I picture that bow, drawn in a perfect arc, ready, in a split second, to cleave the sky with its shining javelin, I must envision also the probability that it may, in a split second, burst into impotent splinters, while I face another laborious month of evenings at the bench. The possible debacle is, in short, an essential element in all hobbies, and stands in bold contradistinction to the humdrum certainty that the endless belt will eventuate in a Ford. A good hobby may be a solitary revolt against the commonplace, or it may be the joint conspiracy of a congenial group. That group may, on occasion, be the family. In either event, it is a rebellion, and if a hopeless one, all the better. I cannot imagine a worse jumble than to have the whole body politic suddenly adopt all the foolish ideas that smolder in happy discontent beneath the conventional surface of society. There is no such danger. Nonconformity is the highest evolutionary attainment of social animals, and will grow no faster than other new functions. Science is just beginning to discover what incredible regimentation prevails among the free savages and the freer mammals and birds. A hobby is perhaps creation's first denial of the peck order that burdens the gregarious universe, and of which the majority of mankind is still a part. The Round River. One of the marvels of early Wisconsin was the Round River, a river that flowed into itself, and thus sped around and around in a never-ending circuit. Paul Bunyan discovered it, and the Bunyan Saga tells how he floated many a log down its restless waters. No one has suspected Paul of speaking in parables, yet in this instance he did. Wisconsin not only had a round river, Wisconsin is one. The current is the stream of energy which flows out of the soil into plants, thence into animals, thence back into the soil in a never-ending circuit of life. Dust unto dust is a desiccated version of the round river concept. We of the genus Homo ride the logs that float down the round river, and by a little judicious birling, we have learned to guide their direction and speed. This feat entitles us to the specific appellation sapiens. The technique of birling is called economics, and remembering of old roots is called history. The selection of new ones is called statesmanship. The conversation about oncoming riffles and rapids is called politics. Some of the crew aspire to burl not only their own logs, but the whole flotilla as well. This collective bargaining with nature is called national planning. In our educational system, the biotic continuum is seldom pictured to us as a stream. From our tenderest years, we are fed with facts about the soils, floras, and faunas that comprise the channel of Round River, biology, about their origins in time, geology, and evolution, about the technique of exploiting them, agriculture and engineering. But the concept of a current with droughts and freshets, backwaters and bars, is left to inference. To learn the hydrology of the biotic stream, we must think at right angles to evolution and examine the collective behavior of biotic materials. This calls for a reversal of specialization. Instead of learning more and more about less and less, we must learn more and more about the whole biotic landscape. Ecology is a science that attempts this feat of thinking in a plane perpendicular to Darwin. Ecology is an infant just learning to talk, and, like other infants, is engrossed with its own coinage of big words. Its working days lie in the future. Ecology is destined to become the lore of Round River, a belated attempt to convert our collective knowledge of biotic materials into a collective wisdom of biotic navigation. This, in the last analysis, is conservation. Conservation is a state of harmony between men and land. By land is meant all of the things on, over, or in the earth. Harmony with land is like harmony with a friend. You cannot cherish his right hand and chop off his left. That is to say, you cannot love game and hate predators. You cannot conserve the waters and waste the ranges. You cannot build the forest and mine the farm. The land is one organism. Its parts, like our own parts, compete with each other and cooperate with each other. The competitions are as much a part of the inner workings as the cooperations. You can regulate them, cautiously, but not abolish them. The outstanding scientific discovery of the 20th century is not television or radio, but rather the complexity of the land organism. Only those who know the most about it can appreciate how little is known about it. The last word in ignorance is the man who says of an animal or plant, "What good is it?" If the land mechanism as a whole is good, then every part is good, whether we understand it or not. If the biota, in the course of eons, has built something we like but do not understand, then who but a fool would discard seemingly useless parts?